That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah. The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Hello, how you doing? I'm Craig Parkinson. You are listening to the Two Shot Podcast. Sit yourself down, pop the kettle on. We're going to have a nice old chat. Who's it with this week? I'm going to tell you right now. How the devil are ya? It's episode 75 of the Two Shot Podcast. How are you doing? Are you alright? I hope you're doing better than me. I really do. Let me tell you what happened. So, Sunday, right, I had the day off work. I'm in this hotel, this lovely hotel in London. So I thought I'm going to get up. I had now to do. I had a couple of things to do, but nothing major. I thought I'm going to have a nice lie-in, which I did. I went for a bath. I'm getting out the bath and I went to pick up the towel and I must have just turned in a wrong way to pick this bloody towel up and I twinged the small on my back. So for the rest of the day, this is what happened. I hobbled to the chemist round the corner to pick up deep freeze cold gel, deep heat rub, bloody muscle and pain, heat back patches, and I spent the rest of the day in bed. In agony. So that was a wasted day, wasn't it? And then 2 days ago, I got this cold flu thing. And last night I slept for 10 and a half hours, sweating it out. So after I do this, I'm going to get the vapor rub in a nice hot bath and have a bit of a steam. So if you're not feeling well, there's a lot of stuff going around at the moment. So my sympathies are with you. Get a podcast in your ear and snuggle up in bed. That's the best thing. Now, speaking of podcasts, apart from this, obviously, I haven't been on other people's podcasts. I've been on two others, apart from last Saturday, where I was invited onto The Cinemile. So if you don't know The Cinemile, check them out at The Cinemile. And the premise is brilliant and very simple. It's Kathy and Dave, who are a married couple. They love film, love it. Watch a little bit too much telly, I think, for my liking. They watch a lot. I don't know how they do it. But what it is they go and pick a film, they go see the film, and then afterwards they get the microphones on, they hit record, and then they talk about the film on the walk home. It's brilliant. We went to see Can You Ever Forgive Me? With Richard E. Grant. Come on, please win the Oscar. And Melissa McCarthy. Yes, please. And we had a lovely, lovely time. They're so lovely. Really nice couple. And had a brilliant time. So a massive thank you to them. Check out The Cinemile. I think you'll really like it. Another shout out, right? For everybody that follows us, you will have noticed that an amazing site called Podcast Word Cloud. Podcast Word Cloud. See, it's because I'm not very well. After every episode of the Two Shot Podcast and many other brilliant, brilliant podcasts, what they do is, well, they make a podcast word cloud. They take little words from the episode and they make this beautiful cloud in fantastic colours and they put it out. So give them a look, right? If you're on Twitter, they're at P Word Cloud, on Instagram at Podcast Word Cloud. Dead simple, go and have a look. And they very kindly sent myself and Griff two mugs this week, which I'm going to get Griff to take a photo of and put on our feeds just so you can see what they do. But they're really, really top guys. So go and check them out. Right, so sorry for waffling. Here we are. It's episode 75. And it's with Cariad Lloyd from the Griefcast. So it's the first time we've got someone coming on. And we do, for the first half, we do talk about podcasts quite a bit, which I'm sure you'll like. Now, you're going to know, apart from the Griefcast, you'll know Cariad from Ostentatious, the improvised Jane Austen show, Toast of London with past Two Shot Podcast guest Matt Berry. You've listened to that episode, haven't you? Go back and listen to it. She was in Peep Show. She was in Murder and Successful with the mighty Big Tom Davis. Oh, come here. Bit closer. I've got Big Tom Davis coming on the podcast this year. Shh. Don't tell. We're just talking about dates at the moment, but it's going to be great. So, this is episode 75 of the Two Shot Podcast. Now, I first met Cariad at the British Podcast Awards last year, where I was reading out the nominees. I can't remember what her... She won three awards, and quite rightly so. It's a brilliant podcast. But I was really chuffed because it was one of my favourite podcasts that I'd started listening to. So that's where I first met her, and she's very honest, and she's open, and she's just natural. She is what she is. And you can always tell when people are putting something on. It's like, I suppose it's like a DJ sometimes. You can really tell if they're not being themselves. And the great thing about Cariad is she kind of always is. So it was lovely to sit down with her. We talk about podcasts. We talk about life, death, comedy. What more do you need? This is episode 75 of the Two Shot Podcast with Cariad Lloyd. I'll see you in a bit. I'm going to run this bath.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Beak Street that my friend, you know Rufus Jones? You ever met Rufus Jones? Yeah, he recommended it. He says really good for self-tapes.
Oh, well, that's good, because Spotlight also do it as well. And they send it off for you
and everything. I've never managed to get to Spotlight, as in, like, I've always found something before I've called Spotlight.
Well, if ever you can't get anywhere, Spotlight's really good, because the guy does it, frames it all for you, someone does the offline, and then he goes, who's it going to? Boom, right, it's done. You walk out, forget about it.
Oh, God, joy.
So none of that fucking WeTransfer hassle. It's all sorted, that's why this studio I thought
because my husband's a filmmaker,
right,
so he normally does it for me, but it's just turning into like constant rows because he's trying to work and then I'm like, I don't like it, I think my hair looks funny, can you do it again? He's like, fuck sake. Well,
that's why you should never watch it back.
Oh, I have to.
Why?
I don't mind watching it back, and I think I make it better, like it doesn't bother me.
But when does it come a point where you go, I've made it. It'll never be there. Like,
but that's the problem with the husband. You too much leeway. But with the studio, or when I've done it before in studio places, I watch it and I'll do about three and then I'm happy. But do you know what I mean? Then I'll walk out. But you're right, with someone you know too well, you can keep going and then you ruin it.
Yeah, I never.
But with studio, I feel like I can watch it and go, oh, I didn't know my eye was doing that. That's what worries me. I watch it like, what the fuck is that hand doing? I thought that was interesting. And I think, okay, wait, just don't do that with your hand, Cariad.
But do you know when you are filming and you're at work?
Have you started?
Yeah.
Oh, is this you start? You don't tell people?
Smooth.
That's cruel.
You think that's cruel?
I could be like, off the record.
Yeah, but the thing is, what I was going to talk...
I was going to eat my sandwich.
You can eat your sandwich, it's fine. Jodie Whittaker was eating scones.
Oh, yes, she was, I heard that, yeah.
Exactly, it's fine, have a bite of sandwich. Because what I was going to... I had no intention of just literally starting like that. I knew you'd started. Did he know?
Because it was about acting suddenly and not about colds. I was talking about colds.
I wasn't even going to start talking about acting. I was going to start talking about podcasting.
Oh, yeah, do that.
Because we've never discussed that.
Not properly, no.
And a few months ago when we were at that podcast do, we both discovered...
Yes, that was so
weird.
That we
both give the guests full editorial control. Yeah.
Which I was surprised not that people don't do that. Like, when me and you were the only... And loads of people were like, oh, really? And me and you were the only people going, of course. How can you not give them full editorial control?
Because otherwise, how can you create a really safe space where people can just let go of any inhibitions and talk about, you know, some deep personal stuff sometimes?
Because my thing, because obviously... So I did the Griefcast, guys. And now you'll plug it in the intro. Because it was about death, and because I had experienced a death when I was young, I always think to myself, and maybe this is where you do it as well, I was like, well, what would I want? And I was like, well, I would want someone to give me control and make sure I was okay with it. So that was my thought. It was like, otherwise I wouldn't be able to talk. And I guess because you're such a successful actor as well, you must think, you can think in that mind frame of like, oh, okay, well, if I was interviewed, this is what I would want. I think that's what's
helpful. I think why did that was a hard and fast rule to start for me, for us, because... I didn't want anybody self-editing.
As
they go along.
Yeah.
Or, you know, if people come on, certainly not on yours, but I would never want... I hate hearing people that's got an agenda.
Yes.
On a podcast. And it's so blatant sometimes.
Yeah, yeah.
And if it's facilitated by the host, then they can both get in the seat. I'm not happy.
So when you were filming with Brad, tell me about it. It must have been so crazy.
I know, it's like really shit questions.
Yeah, yeah. And you know,
and also, I think because I'd read, I love reading interviews with people, but it's very rare that I get a sense of who they are.
Yes.
Because it all comes back to that journalist's point of view.
Yeah.
And I know so many people that felt they've been really stitched up.
Well, I've had the same, that's how I felt. Like, I've been interviewed for stuff years ago about comedy and then read it and gone, oh, what? Why have they, you know... gone for that angle or said that or highlighted that or made that the headline, as I think many people have. So that's really how I felt. It's like, I don't want someone to walk out of this, especially because it's talking about, you know, the most vulnerable thing of their life, the loss of someone they loved deeply. I didn't want them to walk away and go, I don't like that Cariad. She twisted things, because that would just make me want to vomit constantly.
But you see, in this medium, it can't be twisted.
Yeah, yeah, because you can hear everything.
We can hear everything, and it comes from the source.
Yeah, yeah.
And also, because we go, right, you're coming into this, I know it's vulnerable.
Yeah.
Because we're talking about, we're switching the spotlight on you.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel very uncomfortable immediately. I just realised I was being interviewed. I just had a moment of self-awareness. I was like, oh, God, he's talking to me. Shit. Because I've literally just come from doing one. And I'm so used to being able to go, okay, in my head, right, so we're going here. I need to go over there, make sure we don't forget to say that. Oh, they've said that about their dad. Or I must make sure I get, you know. And I just thought, oh, God, I don't have to do that.
You don't have to do that. But we're talking just before it. You seem very relaxed.
Good. It's the turmeric juice that
you're giving. There you go. See, I'll sort you out.
Yeah, yeah.
But we were talking just in the lift orbit very briefly about you saying, because I've just recorded, we're doing 2 days of recordings, and you say that you can only do one
I can't
in a day.
I can't do more than one in a day. I did. I tried it. I tried to do two in a day. And I mean, it depends on the story, because I never ask people for the story beforehand, because I want to be the audience.
Exactly.
So you do, yeah. So I never, and I often, to my own detriment, don't do research. Like, I won't Google them or anything. Sometimes, obviously, I know them, so it's different. But if I don't know the story or anything, so you never know what you're going to get. And I'm sure I could do two. Sometimes it's not a deeply tragic one, but I did two. And it was just, I felt at the end, I guess, you know, I'm not a trained psychotherapist, and I felt at the end, like, overwhelmed with my grief and their grief. And I was like, I just made a rule for these rules that you make when you make a podcast. I thought, right, never do more than two in a day, never do more than three a week, because it's just too much. And then I feel because mine's such an odd thing, I think I feel like I'm in the land of the dead too much. And I start to feel a bit like, ooh, I'm a bit on the other side and I need to remind myself that I'm alive.
Yeah.
And there's sunshine and everything's actually, there's living things. And even though the show is, I think, uplifting and isn't always about death, yeah, too much of delving in people's pain can be...
Well,
yeah,
it is
tricky
hard
for my mental health. I
yeah,
guess.
Well, I've found that as well.
Yeah, yeah.
If I've done a few,
yeah,
and then I have all different people's stories.
Yes, like going whirling mad in your around head. In yes. my head. And
What I've been dealing with this year is how to filter that.
Yeah, how do you do it?
I don't know. I'm still learning.
Yeah, I'm
it's
still
really
learning.
Hard. It's really hard because you're so invested in the conversation and you don't want it to seem like, quote unquote, interview.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
You want it to seem that it's two people talking.
It's a bit like, because I feel like the reason I'm able to do the Griefcast is that whenever I went to a party, without meaning to, I'd start talking to someone, it would turn out they'd been bereaved and we'd have a really intense conversation. But you don't go to parties all the time. Do you know what I mean? So
especially not with children.
Especially not with children. Also, yeah. I'm very socially anxious. So I was never very good at going to parties. And so you might, like, maybe once every couple of months or something, you've been at a party, you had a really intense conversation, you think, oh gosh, and you've got a couple of months to think about it, and you think, oh, that was interesting, and they said that about their dad. And but when you're doing it as a podcast, as a job, suddenly you're doing that three times a week, and it's like, that's never how it used to be. And I guess maybe this, you feel this, like, you're good at talking to people, you like chat, you like conversations, and then when conversations become your job, that's quite a weird... Yeah, to protect yourself, to create boundaries. So we both established these rules for ourselves, haven't we, that make us feel safe. They're just arbitrary rules, really.
Well, yeah, because you have to make somebody who's coming onto your podcast feel safe.
Yeah.
But then again, you can't forget to look after yourself.
That's what I've really had to, especially with my own grief, I've had to be really careful. And it goes up and down, as grief does. So there's some, like, I think I would say, touch wood, I'm very superstitious, I'm quite good at the moment. I'm all right. So I feel like when I'm doing them, I don't feel upset. But at the beginning of the year, I had my dad's anniversary and I was doing Griefcast and I should have stopped doing them. But you know what it's like? It's hard to book them in. It takes ages to organise.
Yeah.
You wake up on that day. And then part of the Griefcast is, I feel like, well, I often start and go, well, I'm not in a good place today. So that's, you know, that's where we're coming. Like, I think that's better for the listeners rather than carry out always being like, I'm fine. My dad tried 20 years ago. And do you know what? I'm great. And I did a podcast about it. You can too. Like, that's not helpful. So, it's, no. You know, you show the snot and the slime and the mess and the flaws. And
well, I think you have to because it's real.
Yeah, that's
And it's
what,
real.
Yeah.
These are real stories. They're not, it's not a true crime podcast.
Exactly. And I think that's more, you know, for my guests as well, if they come in and, you know, they're like, oh, I'm in a bad place. And I'm like, yeah, me too. I'm finding it hard today. You connect on that way rather than, yeah, like...
But then things can move forward from that. If you're honest from the outset...
Yes, massively, yeah, yeah.
Like, I stupidly, a few weeks back, we were both very busy working, myself and Griff, and I'd booked in 5 episodes in a 24-hour period.
No, it's too much. It's too much.
And you know what? I absolutely burnt out.
Yeah,
don't think... There was only... The episodes weren't affected, but I was affected.
Yeah. Oh, I did episodes that were affected. That's what got me. I started listening to them and I was like, I can hear, because you know yourself. I was like, you're not listening. You're worrying. You're thinking about your dad. You're trying to keep your tears back. Like, that's not fair on that guest. And so, to be fair, I'm sure if you listen to the episode... Now you wouldn't be able to tell.
No, but you can.
But I can tell. Yeah, so that's what I then said to myself. Right, carry out. If you're not okay,
don't do it.
Don't do it. Cancel them. It's okay to cancel. Fucking podcast. It's a podcast.
I know.
It doesn't matter. But I think, especially from you come from the acting world, don't you? Like, it's got to get done. The show must go on. You do it.
But if you're not in a good place, you're not in a good place, and you shouldn't do it. I wouldn't.
Yeah.
If I wasn't in a good place, I think, if in all honesty, what I would probably do is I would, you know, I'd book the person in and we'd start, and then I'd probably try and stop halfway through and go, do you know what? This just isn't
working.
It's not working, and it's me because I'm not in a good place.
Yeah.
I think that's what I would do.
Yeah.
Because I would be a bit, no, we've got to do it because I feel a responsibility that we go out every Thursday and people expect it. But it's like, it's just a fucking podcast.
And that's the thing, I think sometimes we're learning, aren't we? Because this is a new medium for everybody, is that podcast, it isn't radio, so it doesn't have, you know, you can have a much more real conversation. It doesn't have to sound perfect, and you can have weeks where it doesn't work, or weeks where, I know you guys, like, you just put that music up and stuff. It was really nice.
Yeah, because I didn't, well, I, you know, I'm dead honest with everybody this, because I think it's the only way forward. And I had an episode to put out, and I fucking lost it. And it's the first time it had happened in, you know, 60-odd episodes. Yeah. It's bound to happen at some point.
Yeah.
And then, as luck would have it, there was a lovely ukulele troupe playing in the hotel, and I spoke to them, and they did it, and it was... it's a little moment.
Yeah.
It's nice.
Think, but again, I think that's the thing of understanding what a podcast is, especially a weekly one, but on a loose topic, and going, it's not as, well, the way that we do our podcast, it's not a series, it's not an arc, it's not a produced narrative, which I love those podcasts, they're great, but that's not what I can't do.
No.
That it's chats on a topic. So yeah, if the chat that week is, you know, not there, that's okay. Yeah, I think that's fine. And I think I've learned to be okay with the mistakes of it, because I used to worry so much about...
What, that it had to be
I wanted perfect. It to be so perfect, yeah, because I came from doing lots of radio, and I would listen to things and go, oh, that doesn't sound right. But then the reason the show happens, I'm sure you feel this about Griff, is my editor, Kate Holland. Like, once she agreed to become my editor, my world changed, because all that pressure of the technology that I just didn't understand, I had someone who was like, no, that's not what a WAV is, carry out. Or where did you put the microphone? And did you press, and do you check the levels? And me being like, what are levels?
Oh, the amount of times he used to do that to me when we first started. I would record different, it's all getting a bit podcast geeky. Probably people have switched off, it's fine. I don't care, it's fine. He said, have you done your levels there? And then I said, I've recorded it, it's fine. Then I sent him it. He went, no, there's nothing there. You have to send the WAV file. So it's just about learning, though.
It is, and also I really like, it feels very cottage industry. So I like that feeling of, like, it feels like we're literally making something with our hands, even though we're using our voices. But it feels really organic. I know it sounds awful. It feels really, like, human and natural. And when, you know, you listen to a podcast, it sounds a bit homemade. I like homemade cakes. I don't like cakes that look perfect. I like cakes that look like someone baked them in their oven. You know what I mean? And that's how I feel about the podcast.
Yeah, I know what you mean, because sometimes, because we record, do you record in like one specific place all the
time?
I
do, yeah. I record at Whistledown Studios mainly. Occasionally I can't use it because bloody Radio 4 book it. But yeah, basically I live at Whistledown Studios. You're very kind to me.
We kind of go around everywhere. But one of our main bases, if we're not in a hotel in London, there's the Maison Berthaud Cafe.
A bit sad we weren't at Maison Berthaud.
Oh, were you?
Because I love my cake so much.
Oh, we'll go back and I'll buy you a cake.
Because I looked at the address and I was like, oh, I'm going to get such a good cake with Craig. And I was like, hang on, there's not the cafe in Soho.
I'm sorry.
Don't be silly.
But because we have...
I've got a pret sandwich and a turmeric juice.
And you're all right. But we have little, like, you know, teacups and in the background. And it's
lovely.
Kind of nice,
yeah,
because
nice.
I think it paints a picture for the listener.
I was listening to one the other day and someone just came in and you were both like, hello, okay. Anyway, so when I was at school... And I thought, it's nice. It feels real. And I think that's a new type of audio, which is really exciting.
But if our podcast were topic-based, or it was a series and it was about something week to week, doing it in that, the environment connects with the podcast.
Yeah,
So to do that at Maison Berthaud, a true crime or some story that I was doing over 6 or 7 weeks... It just wouldn't work.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why I love podcasts so much, because I listen to some that are so highly produced and I love it. I have no problem, but I like that we can all exist. Whereas at the moment in radio, really, it's a very distinct style of comedy, for example, that exists on radio, and it's quite hard to get anything else through those doors.
If it doesn't fit that Radio 4 mould type
of thing. Yeah, that style and that tone and the sound. And I think if you don't listen to a lot of radio, it's hard to pin down. But I can listen in 2 minutes, I'm like, oh yeah, that's a Radio 4 comedy. And that's what I like about podcasts. It's like, it feels like, at the moment, it feels like anyone can... I can swear here, can't I?
So it's actively encouraged.
Okay, good. Like, it feels like anyone can fucking do it. It doesn't feel like... It feels very... not utilitarian, but like, you know, fair. It just feels very fair that... the messy ones can live us right next to the ones that are produced with loads of money, and we can all be judged exactly the same.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's why I love anything that levels. That's why I like comedy so much. It just levels everyone. I don't care what university you went to or how you talk, because basically it's like, are you making me laugh, really? Although you can get into unconscious bias, but let's not go there.
Well, not yet. Anyway,
not yet,
so
I know,
early.
I know. I go deep very early, because it's grief cost.
Switch off the grief cost.
Yeah, yeah.
Are you good at switching off?
No, I'm terrible at it. Yeah, I'm terrible at it.
I mean, not just involved with grief cost, but in
just
life.
Just in life, yeah.
Work.
No, I'm a very anxious, over brain ticking too much person. Yeah, I don't know if I come across like that. I think if you really know me, you know, like, it's a constant whirl of anxiety and neurosis, and I can worry about everything, like, and anything. So I find it really hard to switch off, but that's why I like doing comedy. I find a switch off when I do improv, like, my brain just literally bless you.
I'm so sorry.
it's real guys, it's
real. Like, he does have a cold.
He has a cold. God, he really, he's doing such a good impression of an actor with a cold.
skills.
It's really good. Yeah, when I do improv, my brain switches off, which is why I think I'm, like, addicted to it. Because it's like, I guess if someone drinks and they don't think when they're drinking, I don't have that. But when I do improv, I forget.
Does something else take over then?
Yeah, like, the story takes over and the improv takes over. And it's like I'm... Yeah, it's like my... Because, you know, I used to teach improv quite a lot, and when you're improvising, you will say to people, that part of your brain that's saying, you're shit, you're crap, don't say that, look at the way they're looking at you, oh my God, what the fuck, everyone hates you, also your shoes are rubbish. Like, that has to be switched off, otherwise you can't hear the story. So I always used to say to people, that voice, you have to literally volume knob, turn it down, so there's silence in your head, so that when anyone says anything, you're like, okay, he's Lord Hardcastle, he's got a daughter that needs to get married, and I'm playing the sister of her best friend, so you have to have more, you know, you just can't do both. And I find that it's like a peace for me when I'm improvising. That example was from Ostentatious, because I do. Okay, so I thought, what a weird improv example, because I do a show called Ostentatious, improvised Jane Austen. So it's like,
people just shout out. Is it? They just shout out from the audience.
No, well, so it's improvised again. I am a fucking geek. So it's improvised long form.
Don't apologise for
that. I know. So short form is like Whose Line Is It Anyway style games where people shout out stuff, and you're like, oh, Napoleon. Oh. Prostitute. That's what they don't. Please stop shouting that in pro shows. It's really annoying. Anyway, long form is where you're telling a story, and the way Ostentatious works is you get given a slip of paper that looks like an old Penguin book, and you write down a forgotten title of a book. So it doesn't have to be Jane Austen pun, but we've had like Mansplain Park, Queer Eye for a Regency Guy, Strictly Come Darcy, 00 Darcy. Mansfield Jurassic Park, you know, these are just some. And then we get shout outs at the beginning. We have about 3 or 4, and then we just choose one, and that's it. No more shout outs. And then we just do the story.
Just like that?
Yeah, then we just do it basically a comedy play in the style of Jane Austen for 90 minutes. But really, once you understand improv, you don't. The constant shout outs are to prove you're making it up. And improv has moved to a new place now, which is really exciting. Where it's like, there's nothing wrong with short form. I still do it at the Comedy Store with the Comedy Store players. I love it. But long form allows you to go, I don't need to prove I'm making it up. I am. Look, here I am doing it. And I don't need you saying, oh, do it like it's a film noir for me to, you know. So we just do it in the style of Jane Austen in full Regency gear with a violinist and piano accompanying us. And that's it. Then we just do it. I'm gabbling to explain it because I'm so used to explaining it.
No, but I know there'll be so many people that haven't.
That's what I realised. I was like, I haven't explained what it is. It is a bit of an odd thing. So we're in the West End now. So we're monthly at the Savoy, and we just announced we're going weekly at the Fortune Theatre next year.
How are you juggling all these things at the moment?
Badly.
And
badly.
Being a mum?
Badly. Yeah, too much. It's too much. I had a bit of I was in a play in October when I saw you, and then I was also still trying to do grief casts while doing a play, whilst co-writing a panto, whilst doing a Channel 4 thing, and doing Ostentatious, which is like another of my babies. So, yeah, I...
Ever feel you take on too much?
Yep, maybe. I think, again, it's that thing of trying to stop your brain, because my brain's so busy. So it's like the more things I do, you know. And I don't know if this is coming from being more of a comedy actor. Like, there's always this, like, you make your own work. You've got to make your own work. So you're making your own work, and then you get other work. But you can't stop the other work that you've made, because that's the stuff that keeps you
going.
Exactly. So that's the thing that like made you, is the fact that you can go, I don't need anyone, I can produce something. And then it's, you can't just stop that because someone goes, oh, will you be in my play or my film or my TV show? You're like, yes, but also I must keep that going, because when you stop asking me to be in a TV show, there'll be nothing.
And so that needs to keep going, because that's where it all started and work breeds work.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it's hard. It's hard to not, you're on a bit of a treadmill, and it's sometimes hard to notice that you are on the treadmill because that's just your life. So yeah, I'm planning a quiet Christmas.
Are you good at saying no and stopping?
I'm terrible.
Why is it? Because you're terrified that it will all stop, or?
Yeah, I didn't really get to do what I wanted to do until I was about 28, 29, 27. So I still have the fear that I'm not going to be able to do what I want to do, because it was so hard to do what I want to do. And I'm very good friends. I always say best friends, people laugh. My best friend is Sarah Pascoe, who's also stand-up, and we, you know, came up the university together and just fought. So we're just trying to be actors and performers and not getting anywhere. So we both really find it hard to still say no, because there's still that voice in your head that's like, oh my God, so-and-so wants me to do this, like a little read through for free at this really cool theatre. Like, you can't, there's still that little actor in you that's like, they want me to say words. Oh, okay.
me.
Yeah. And it sounds contrived, because then people go, oh, well, you're doing so well or something. You're like, it never feels like that, obviously. And also my best friend, Sarah Pascoe, look how well she's doing. She's amazing. She's so prolific and works so hard. So I always feel like, oh, there's always more I could be doing. So yeah, I just find it really hard. But I'm trying to get better. And since having a baby, I've got better. Definitely a lot of the crap, I've just gone, no, I'm not coming to do your unpaid improv gig to six people.
Like, well, you have to balance it, don't you?
Yeah, yeah.
I know we all need to put food on the table.
Yeah, yeah.
And buy nappies, but it's like,
it's tricky. And what I think, we're going really psychology here, that my dad was self-employed. He ran his business from home. So I am very used to, like, I grew up watching someone not going to bed. Like, you'd wake up and he'd, you know, he's still in his home office and, you know, 4 o'clock in the morning, he's just walking around, he's typing, he's dictating something. So I think that's normal. I think it's normal to be on your laptop for as long as you physically can, because you've got to pay the bills. And obviously when you're self-employed, you never know when the next place it's coming from.
Yeah,
and you have
exactly.
No security. So that to me is my normal. So he was a workaholic 100%. And I definitely have picked up that way of surviving, of being like, that's how you survive. You just work, 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 work. And I am trying. I've definitely got better. I'm trying to sort of go, hang on a minute. Are you happy? And I think, yeah. Not. I need to get better at that. It's hard. It's just hard. And then sometimes you say yes to the shit job, and it turns out to be brilliant. Do you know what I mean?
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? You never know.
You never know.
But the gut will try and guide you as best it can.
I've definitely tried to get better at listening to myself and just being like, do I feel sad when I've written that email saying yes, I'll do that? am I like, oh, yeah, I'll do that?
There's a little part of me.
Little part of me just died. Yeah. And so then I try and But what's hard, I think, is once you get into a busy period, I find it hard to come out of that. Do you know what I mean? You have this moment, it's like, oh, all these projects are happening at once. And then to sort of go, oh, well, now they've stopped. I'm not very good at going, oh, that's good, they've stopped. I'm like, oh, I better fill that gap with another project. Shit. And it's like, no, you're not doing the play. That's okay. You don't have to do the play.
I suppose sometimes, though, when you're doing, specifically you, when you're doing all these different things, and they are very different.
It's so different,
so if you are filming, or you are doing Ostentatious, or you are doing the podcast, they're different things, so you're putting a different head on.
Which is really exciting.
Yeah.
And partly why I didn't want to work in an office doing the same thing every day. That was the whole thing. I was like, I want my life to be exciting and stimulating. But it's like, it's a bit like Technicolor. You know, sometimes I'm like, oh, I might need a break from like how bright this is. And they are all really different. And again, that's, someone said to me, like, oh, why have you made this choice? And I was like, it's not a choice, just like what happened.
Yeah.
Like things that interest me, I just follow. And
sometimes they snowball and
they
become,
and sometimes they don't.
Much bigger. This keeps dropping. Really,
I know,
sorry.
Because like sometimes they don't, and people go, oh, you've done all these strange different things. But you're like, yeah, but you haven't heard about all the other, there's plenty of other projects that didn't get off the ground because they were shit or they didn't work or, you know, these are just the things that got off the ground.
But sometimes things don't work.
Yeah, which is fine.
Which is fine.
But that's what you're throwing like 25 balls into the air and then you've got 5 left and everyone's like, oh, that's a lot of balls. You're like, you should have seen how many I started with. Yeah. It was fucking loads. This is just everything that's like somebody went, I like that. And you're like, well, I'm such a like sort of, I think coming from such a comedy background, it's like, they liked it. Do it more, do it bigger. And anything they don't like, you're like, okay, chuck it, throw it, kill it, it doesn't work. Like, I don't have that kind of artistic, no, they're just wrong and they'll catch up with me. I'm like, fuck it, didn't work, move on.
Yeah.
Do you like this? It's shiny, do you like it? Great, okay, more of that, more shiny stuff. Yeah, but I don't know, I like it as well. Like I say, it's very stressful and when it's too much, it's stressful, but when it's balanced and you somehow manage to go from doing an improv gig as a Jane Austen character to interviewing someone fascinating about their grief and their loss to the next day, you know, acting in a play that you think the writing's amazing, everyone in the play is brilliant, the directing's great, and you're in this great venue. That's brilliant. That's the life I wanted. It's just, sometimes it's a bit stressful. That's all.
Do you sleep well?
I do, I think, because
that's
I didn't used to.
General
yeah.
question, but...
No, I know what you mean, and sleep and mental health are obviously
well, yeah.
connected. I do because I'm so tired. I think if I didn't have... When I didn't have the baby, I used to be a real night owl, and I would stay up working till like 2 a.m. But now, fuck that. You've got to get up at 6. Like, that's actually really helped. And I have quite a noisy neighbour as well, and we just don't care because we're just so tired. Like, he listens to the boxing, like, full volume at, like, 4 a.m, and I just wake up and think, oh, he's got the boxing on, and I go back to sleep. And I think it's good... If we moved house, and I was like, oh, if we'd moved before having a child, I'd be infuriated. I'd be like, he's ruining my life. And now I'm like, children tire you out in such a different way. Like, well, the tiredness I have for looking after her is so different.
It's mental and physical.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And even though sometimes when I get really tired, if I start thinking that I can't switch off my brain,
yeah,
then that snowballs, and I'm worried that I can't switch off.
Oh God, yeah, have that.
Then I'm looking, going, oh, it's 2 o'clock.
Yeah,
oh, it's 3 o'clock.
I get up and read. It's happened to me recently. I said it got a bit much. Everything got a bit overwhelming, and I used to meditate or read or do pages. Have you had a morning pages from the Artist Way?
No.
So the
explain to me.
So the Artist Way is this, I would say, book that changed my life. It's by a woman called Julia Cameron. And she's an ex-alcoholic, so it is a 12-step program for creativity. And she kind of nicked, I think, a lot of the AA steps of looking at yourself and working out why. But it's about working out... I'm just gabbling again to explain something. It's about working out why you're creatively blocked or what's happening with your creativity or what your process is. And it doesn't have to be writer, dancer, actor, painter. Just getting you being creative. And one of the things she says that you have to do is every morning you get up and you do morning pages. And morning pages are three, you have to handwrite them 3 sides. It can be A4, just a notebook, whatever. You just have to do 3 complete sides without thinking, and it's the first thing you do. And when I did The Artist's Way is when I wrote my first Edinburgh show. Like, it changed my life. And then I went to Edinburgh and I got nominated and I got an agent. And before that, nothing was happening.
Because you were blocked creatively? Or...
Yeah, I think because I was blocked creatively and I was not doing what I wanted to do. You know, I was confused and lost and trying to work, you know, and I was just... Lots of reasons for me. But yeah, she works out... Like, she goes through, like, school stuff and... Not dissimilar to this podcast of, like, what is it that's stopping you? And even it could even be you can do it when you're extremely creative and be like, oh, am I stuck in a rut? Like, where do I want to go? But the morning pages are just an amazing tool because she calls it your self-censor. You end up writing like, oh, I'm shit on this and this and this. And then I think in the act of writing it, you look at it and you think, that's not fair. Why am I being so horrible to myself? But in your head, it's very easy to have a silent argument. But to have to write down, and often you write down the same problem every day. So for like 3 weeks, you might be writing down this person has done this or this. And then you start looking and you think, God, I really should talk to them, shouldn't I? It's obviously really bothering. You know, it's like mini therapy kind of thing. And I did it every day for like 5 or 6 years. Now I've had a baby. Do I get up early to write some shitty pieces of paper? No, I don't. But when I can't sleep. It's a really good way. You just write 3 sides, just handwrite them, and it just get whatever's going on. The ticking in your brain is what I call it. Whatever's ticking, it's just on the page.
And it's come out, you've got it
dumped.
Out of your system.
Yeah, it's dumped, it's out of your system, and you think, oh, well, there it is, it looks silly now, or that's not so bad. Or you think, oh, I need to talk to someone, actually, or, you know, not even therapy. I just need, like, oh, I probably need to have a chat with that friend. They've clearly upset me. Or I'm overreacting.
But
oh.
It is different when it's written down to what yeah. it is in your head.
Yeah.
Or if you actually speak it out loud yeah, and have yeah. that conversation exactly. with whoever it is.
And I think just the act of writing, the act of doing something creative to express what's happening in your head starts teaching you how to write things down. I say it's not just for writers, but it's an incredible, incredible tool. And I can't... I will caveat that the book is very God-heavy and quite American, and some people don't like that, but I'm a pick and choose girl, so I'm just like, just take what you like from yeah. it. But you know, she says she's like, you don't have to call it God, whatever you want to call it, just a higher power that moves you creatively, which sounds very hippie-ish, I guess. But
also, if you read something like that, I'm gonna have to, reminds me of a book that I read a couple of years ago, and I'll have to find what it is and put it in the intro. But there was only certain sections of it that really spoke to me.
Yes.
There was a lot of CEO type of speak in
yes.
it.
Yes, yeah, yeah,
but
yeah.
the things that pinged out yeah. were brilliant. So you do have to pick and choose. Yeah, I'm exactly yeah. the same. Because not... And also, some of that CEO stuff might work for somebody else, exactly. but it don't work for me.
Exactly.
That's a very personal thing. Yeah. So you take what's going to be useful yeah, to you yeah. and stick it in your tool bag.
And I think it's a, like, if you don't live your life like that, you end up missing out on a lot of stuff. If you're like, oh, well, she's mentioning God, so I don't want to read this book. I'm like, oh, you're going to miss out on, like, two really good pearls. So maybe just ignore the stuff that winds you up.
And don't put a block on it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But it's a fascinating book. And it's a 12-week program, and you do different exercises. Like, every Sunday, you just sit down and have to write and answer different questions. And by the end of it, I wrote an Edinburgh show. And I realised, like, oh, I'm trying to stop myself. That's what's happening. I'm self-sabotaging and I'm afraid. And, oh, OK. And once you know it, you can, like, oh, OK, well, now I can go and do that. I can go and yeah. fix it. So, yeah, I would say, like, fundamentally changed my life. I'm a bit evangelical about it.
So, speaking of Edinburgh.
Yes.
What did come first, the comedy or the acting? The love of what?
Acting was always first, always. Like, when I was a kid, like, my parents... It always sounds very middle class, but my mum isn't at all. But they would take us to the theatre all the time. But we would go and see, like, RSC and Shakespeare and all
musicals.
Was this
in London? Did you grow up in London?
I grew up in London, despite the very Welsh name. I am not as Welsh as some people would like me to be. Do even Michelle can I? That means I don't speak Welsh, for people who get upset. But my dad's side are Welsh, but they moved to London. So we would go to the theatre all the time. So I thought acting was... acting. Like, I didn't know you could do anything else.
Right.
So I thought, if you said you wanted to be an actor, that meant you wanted to play Lady Macbeth and go to Stratford-upon-Avon. Like, what else is there? So I definitely wanted to be an actor. And then we would obsessively watch comedy in my house, obsessively. I just didn't know it was a job. I thought, well, those were those people. They got to do that. I don't think anyone could do that. Whereas acting, it was like, no, you go and you're like, it's like a vocation. You can do it. But nobody said there's a comedy school. Like, I didn't know what Edinburgh was. Weirdly, yeah. they never took us to the festival. But we would just go and see shows all the time. So I was very, like, theatre literate from a young age. And that's what I just thought.
Was it both? Was it your mum and dad who had that passion for theatre?
Yeah, they really liked going to shows. Like I said, my mum is... extremely working class, but she married well. She did well, that's what I say in the family. And so I think my dad's side is more like, it's what you do, you take the children to the theatre. And my mum loves a show, she just loves a good show, you know. And so, yeah, we lived in London and...
It was accessible.
Yeah, we lived in the suburbs, so you just jump on the tube. And then by the, you know, time we... So one of my earliest memories is being, I think I was about four, and I went to see Macbeth at Regent's Park Open Air Theatre.
At four.
And I saw Nicola McAuliffe, who I still... And she was trying to get the blood out, and they had a flame on the stage, and she had her hands in the flame. And I can remember I've got tartan blanket over me, and we were right near the front. Like, my dad was always a bit like, gotta get the best tickets. So we were right near it, and I was like, and I thought, she's killed them, and she's trying to burn her hands, and it won't come up. And I remember thinking, what will she do? And I just thought, I was completely gone. Like, I was hook, line, and sinker. And I thought, that's what I want to do. Like, that's
4 years old.
Four, yeah. I was like, but I really thought, it's really what I want. But I just thought, oh, you know, how does one do that sort of thing? Nobody in my family is theatrical. Like, they liked going to theatre, but there's no...
That's where it stops.
Yeah. Oh, my God. My grandpa was a very good orator. He was a solicitor, and we've got recordings of him speaking, and he's insane. I mean, he sounds like Richard Burton. It's the Welsh one. It's insane how good a speaker he is. Like, I wish I could just play it to people, because he does this speech, and it's a pure lesson in how to, you know, hold a crowd. It's just so, yeah, he's incredible. So he was a performer in that way, but yeah, he was a solicitor. He was a lawyer. He wasn't. There's no acting ever in any of them at all.
Sometimes they're the best actors.
Oh, he used to get drunk and say, "I could have been John Gielgud if I'd wanted." Caliad, I could have been John Gielgud. But he also used to say, "We could have been Sainsbury's," because his dad owned a sweet shop and they sold it. If we'd held on to the sweet shop, we could have had a sweet shop in every town in Wales. We could have been Sainsbury's, as rich as Sainsbury's now. It would have been Lloyd's on every corner. And I was like, yeah, okay. So he had quite a lot of theories about what he could have been. He was actually a very successful lawyer. So yeah, the comedy came much, much later. I thought comedy was very silly, not important, not worthwhile. And because I would say my family's very funny, and we're very good at making each other laugh, I thought, and it sounds arrogant, I don't want to sound arrogant, but I thought comedy was easy. It's easy to accents, it's easy to make people laugh, it's easy to put on a silly voice, become a character and do something silly. Like, it's easy, that's easy. What's hard is doing Lady Macbeth and putting your hands in the fire.
It's so, the quote-unquote real acting. Yeah.
So I thought comedy was, like, not proper. God. It wasn't proper at all. And it took me till I was 28 to go, I think what you have is a skill at comedy, and that's valid. I just thought it was really worthless for so long. I just thought it was who cares, you know. And I remember doing a read through once, and someone said, how are you doing that? And I said, what? And they were like, you're doing something on that joke, it's not funny and you're doing something. And I didn't know what he was talking about. I was like, I'm just saying it, like. And I thought, oh, maybe he can't make that maybe he doesn't know how to make that funny. I thought, why doesn't he know how to make that funny? Like, just, you know, just do that and it'll be funny. I started thinking, this sounds really arrogant, but I started accepting, oh, perhaps it's a thing that I can do, rather than...
But it doesn't sound arrogant, because there's a real skill to comedy. And being, I don't want to say a comedy snob, but somebody who grew up, which is all I ever wanted to do, was do comedy.
Really?
Absolutely.
That's so funny. It's always the way everybody wants to do the other thing. I mean, always. So many comedians who want to be actors. And all the actors are like, I'd love to do stand-up.
But I grew up, you know, watching Harold Lloyd and Lauren Hardy and Brie getting into it and going, oh, they did that there.
Oh,
really,
wow, yeah.
Trying to strip it all away and look exactly why that's funny.
Yeah, yeah.
So much so that it became quite obsessive.
I definitely had that, but I didn't think, I don't know, like, I would watch stuff, but I would just, I felt like I just knew. I was like, oh, I see what they're doing that. Okay, that's, oh, so if you want it to be funny, you need the tone of that needs to do that. And I would watch Julie Walters and Victoria Wood a lot, and I was very, very into them, and very into, like, oh, I see, you know, that phrasing that Victoria Wood would do, and the referencing, you know, some, if you add, you know, a shrug, a jumper and a biscuit, you've somehow got a character. And I was like, oh, how, that's interesting, you know. But I just didn't think it was any on even on the table. It was like watching a documentary about doctors. It was like, oh, right, that's how doctors do it. They're like, oh, interesting. I mean, I'll never be able
to
do that.
I can never do that.
How would you do that? Oh, very nice to know.
So what did you want to do when you were at school, and how was school? Just now we're slipping backwards.
We're slipping backwards. I know, sorry, I jump around.
No, that's what I do. It's what we should do.
Yeah, school was fine. I didn't like it. I didn't really like it, but it wasn't... It's really hard to sum up my school sometimes. And I knew you were going to ask me, so I've been thinking about it, because you always ask me about their school. And I was like, oh, God. I had a delightful primary school, like... absolutely ridiculous. It was in the middle of a square, was the whole primary school, and there was four roads around it, and we all literally all crossed the road to the primary school, and all our mums were friends, and so I've still got friends from that square.
Right.
Which, and I think sometimes when you grow up in London, people don't realise that London is a collection of villages. So, like, if I go back to my hometown, my village of London, like, I get stopped, you know, we all know each other, but people, I think sometimes it's like, oh, London's so huge and horrible. It's like, if you grow up here, it isn't, you know, especially in the suburbs. It's like, everyone knows everyone's business, and all the mums know each other and the dads, and then so-and-so's left so-and-so, but their house is always going up for £1 million. All our houses are worth a fortune. That's the one good thing, because we live in London, but we can't sell them. Anyway, so my primary school, I think, was lovely. Secondary school was... it's almost, oh, it's, how do I describe it? It's extremely academic school, and I was very miserable there. But if I walked you around it, you'd laugh your head off, because it's like such a good school, and people fight to get their children into there still. Like, it's very high up. And it's, no, I will tell you about it. It is a really weird school because it was actually created in the 1500s by a dame, and it is part of the Guild Schools. So it's by the Worshipful Company of Brewers.
Right.
And it used to be for the poor boys of Islington. And yes, Spandau Ballet, if you're listening, I went to the same school as you, because Gary and Martin Kemp also went there. And it used to be in Islington for the poor boys, right? And they moved it out to the suburbs, and it suddenly became extremely posh middle class school. But we had a school song. We used to get beer money at the end of the year.
What?
Yeah. So, because it's owned by the Worshipful Company of Brewers. So weird. So like a guild, you know, like the guild of like weavers or copper merchants. So the brewers somehow still involved. And at the end, because in the 1500s, beer was better for kids, for the boys, than water, because in London it was cleaner. They used to give out beer money to the poor boys of Islington, and this tradition still maintains. So these men turn up with, like, ermine gowns and, like, gold. Like, they look like, all look like mayors. And you all have to look your best. And you go at the end of the year. Oh, and we had a school pub. And the end of the year, you
sounds
go.
Sounds like a great school. Yeah, exactly. What are you miserable about?
You go in and you have to hold your hand out, and you're not allowed to say thank you. You have to nod your head, and you get £1 in the first year, £2 in the second year, £3. And by like upper six, you get £7. But that's like to like 200 pupils, and we'd all have to go in and hold our hand out. If you're listening, you know what school I'm talking about, and you'll be surprised that I went there.
I've spoken about many schools.
Yeah, it's really weird.
Nothing like this.
I know, and we had a school pub. You could drink at when you were 17, so it was a private members bar, and the teachers and the pupils would all drink there.
Together?
Yeah.
There wasn't a segregation, teachers?
Sort of, yeah. You're just kind of all in the pub together, because it's the school pub. Because it's owned by the brewery. I know, it's such a... Like, I grew up thinking it was obviously very normal. It wasn't until I got to uni and I started being like...
People were going, a school pub?
Yeah, exactly. And then we had a school song, and so it's like a public school, but it wasn't public school. But it has all the trappings of history and tradition, but it was completely not, you know, a state school. That just happens to be, I don't understand how it works, but the brewers are involved in some way. So, but it was also very academic, and I wasn't very academic, and terrible at drama. And I'll say that on the record, it's fucking awful. And drama was treated as a pathetic...
Secondary.
Not even sec, like four, like, I mean, the idiots, if the idiots want to do a play, good luck to them. But it's not, music was what you were encouraged to do. So they have like this, they built this insane like music hall and... like orchestral pit and stuff, and so like it's the best in the whole of the county for music and orchestras. But
music is held in
music is intellectual, yeah.
Right, okay, of course.
And so it's a very intellectual school, and so if you weren't if you weren't doing maths or physics or you know playing violin and heading to Oxbridge, you were not very interesting to them. So yeah, I found it.
Is that why you found it miserable?
Yeah, I think I sort of got defined as, like, I would say, like, I used to get Bs a lot. I used to get a B+, and, like, I still feel a chip on my shoulder. That was not good enough at my school.
Oh, my God.
And so I, you know, I'm a perfectionist anyway, and I went to a school where it was like, if you're not getting an A*, why should we give you our time? And so if you got... Yeah, exactly. And the only thing I excelled at was English. It was the only place I was special and I was good, and that's why I ended up... doing an English degree, because it was the only thing I felt like I was worth talking about. That was the only thing in my whole school that they would be like, oh, she got an A* on that. But drama was like, yeah, I mean, I got terrible marks for drama, and they didn't encourage us. And acting was like, it just wasn't a job. In their opinion, it wasn't a job.
It's not realistic.
It's not real. It's not. Why on earth would you... Are you insane? You're not gonna. It's not how you make money, and it's not worthy of your time. So I found, you know, the idea of applying to drama school was like, well, I didn't know you. I didn't know you could. I didn't know you could apply. I didn't know it was a thing.
Did you ever start to believe it? Because they're getting that drummed into you all the time. You go, well, maybe it isn't. Maybe it isn't a realistic career opportunity.
Yeah, definitely. That's how I felt. I had no one in my family doing it. I had one friend who I'm still friends with, who's still an actor, and she had done a lot of acting as a child, and she was like, I'm going to drama school. And I remember thinking, like, I thought she was very brave. But also, I think we have to caveat this, that my dad died when I was 15. So in the middle of this world, the hugest thing possible happened to me. So in the middle of being a very gothy, angry teenager who feels like, oh, this school's so shit, no one understands me, the bottom falls out of my world. So then what has taken me a long time to realise is what happens when you lose a parent as a teenager is you become very vulnerable and you don't trust anything because nothing's safe anymore. So the people go different ways. Some people go off the rails and take loads of drugs. They're like, fuck it, we're going to die. And I went very like, we're going to die. So like, I better not do anything very dangerous or scary. So I'm going to go to university because that's safe. And they've told me the drama school is not safe. So I don't want to be not safe because that's where people die. Okay, fine. So I went into very like, just do what you can to
like,
survive. Like, so yeah, I think it's very hard for me to talk about school. Not hard, but like it's confusing because when a grief like that happens in the middle of it, how can you really judge it, you know? So for then, you know, that was 2 weeks before my GCSEs. So I did them and then I had 2 years of sixth form at the same school and I just didn't give a shit. Obviously, my dad had died, I just didn't. By then, I just was like...
Well, perspectives.
Yeah, perspectives. I just didn't care. I didn't care. And then they would start with the Oxbridge stuff and I just didn't care. I just didn't... Oh, who gives a shit? And now I'm annoyed because I think I wish I'd paid more attention to... Oh, Cambridge has this really good drama, you know, footlights and stuff. And but I didn't care.
You were dealing with what was going on at that time, yeah, in that
exactly.
moment.
And exactly.
if you go back and go, oh, if only, then you wouldn't have dealt with it exactly. the way it had, and you yeah, would be where you are
yeah.
now. So
exactly. No, I know. It's just But I wasn't very happy there. But I'm still friends with people that I met there. So you know, it wasn't terrible. It was just not the right school for me, I think, in some ways.
So going to university to study English.
Yeah.
What was the plan there?
No plan.
No plan.
No
just,
plan.
Let's just do something.
It was like what all my, you know, I just was doing what I was told. It was like you have to do your GCSEs, then you have to do your A levels, then you have to go to university. That's what you do. And literally, no, that's all my friends from school. We all went to university. It was like that kind of academic school. It was like you go and get a degree
yeah.
and then you go and get a job. And if you're not going to work in the city, we assume you're going to be a teacher. And if you're not going to do that, you're going to get married. So I was like, okay.
You'd be a good housewife.
Yeah. So I took a year out and I did some travelling and then I just went to uni because I thought I literally don't know what the fuck else to do. Because in the tiny back of my voice was like, you want to be an actor? And I was like, shut up. That's not an option. So don't heartbreak. It's heartbreaking to think about what I want to do because it's not an option for me. Other people are allowed to do that and I'm not. So I have to just forget about it and walk away. Like a man who doesn't love you. So you just got to walk away. You can't do it. So I was like, well, I'll go to uni then.
God, you were suppressing that for
so long. Yeah, yeah. And then the first thing I did was audition for a play.
When you were at uni?
Yeah, yeah.
Just sort of get out of your system because it's...
Well, I was like, I thought it was okay to have it as a hobby. I thought, well, I'm allowed it as a hobby. They can't take that from me.
No.
I'm allowed to do it as a hobby and then, you know, I'll become an English teacher, but I'll, you know, I'm allowed to still... And also, you know what? It was really fun. I went to audition for the play and I thought, if I don't get it, then there's your answer. You're not good enough anyway. And then I got in the play and I thought, oh, okay, well, that's exciting.
Dangling the carrot in front of you.
Yeah, it was. And then I met my two best friends in this play. So I met Sarah Pascoe and Vanessa Hummick, who are still my extremely good friends. And we then started doing lots of, you know, I started doing loads of drama stuff. And I started choosing to study drama and, you know, writing about Shakespeare or doing a film course. It was all performance, like, hidden in English literature. Which was great. Sussex let me do that. So, you know, that was really nice. And then we started directing plays. And it really, honestly, another turning point was Pascoe, because she was just like, we're going to do it. We're going to be actors. And I was like, what? She's like, we're just going to do it. Just are. And I was like, okay. And I thought, well, I'm just going to follow her because...
She seems to know what she's doing.
And she said, she said after uni, we won't get jobs that are boring jobs. We're going to get performing jobs. Because she'd worked as a singer in like hotel bars and stuff.
She worked
at Millennium Dome as well as a performer. Oh, you've got to get a Pascoe on. So her life's amazing. And so she was like, you can get jobs that are performing. You don't have to do boring jobs. Because I come from a, you know, you get a job at a bank and that's what you do. So she said, we're going to go and do TAE. And then she got me a job on the buses as tour guide. So we're going to do tour guides because you're performing.
Yeah.
So she was like always, you know, with the old, what was the old PRA? What was that like? Do you ever used to have to get it through the post and it would tell you the jobs?
Oh.
PR something.
PCR.
It?
Yeah, it was always red.
Always red.
All different colours. I remember red in my mind.
You had to get it through the post. That's how old we are. And she'd be like, right, there's a job here. And, you know, we'd obviously try and avoid the escort jobs. But it was always like, what can we do that's
needs
performing?
Must sometimes. Yeah, you've got exactly. to put food on the table.
It was like, what can we do? And then, yeah, I started doing more performing jobs and realising... Oh, you can... And then I thought, okay, I can do... I'm not going to be an actor, but I can still perform. and earn money. So I'm going to, you know, I'm going to do these other things. But I'm obviously I'll never, ever do the, what I really want to do. But at least I won't be in an office. But
then so
I,
was your confidence building throughout this? Or was it getting a battering?
I don't know. It was getting a battering as well because it was, you know, occasionally just doing a series of awful fringe plays as well. I did
which
so many.
Which were soul destroying.
Sometimes it was. Sometimes they were wonderful. Obviously, sometimes it's brilliant, and sometimes it's six people, and you're all shit. And like, as in the people in the you included are shit.
Yeah.
The play's shit. The directing's shit. You're shit. The people you're acting against are shit. And you think they're bad, and I'm bad, and this is bad. And that's you know.
And so I might as well just give it all up. Well, everything's bad. Yeah.
Give it up. It's too hard. And then I would temp as well. I did loads of temping. I worked in investment banks. I worked in a place that sold Viagra. I worked in an advertising company. I worked I just literally went around London in different offices, and then it was getting into comedy was where the confidence because that was the one place where I was good.
So where I mean, we've already established where the comedy comes from, but it's a very different thing to being such a massive fan and doing a certain style of comedy to...
Yeah, it's such a weird... As ever, it's such a weird journey. So I left university and I was looking at courses. So City Lit ran lots of acting courses, but I saw this course that said short form impro. And I thought, well, I love Whose Lines Are... That's one of my favourite shows. So I could do a course in it. You know, again, I can't... Not allowed to do it, but it'd be fun to do it, yeah. You know. And I did... I rang them, they said, we've got no spaces. Oh, okay, fine. Give up, carry on temping. And then they rang me 2 weeks later. They said, oh, someone's dropped out. Do you want to do it? And I thought, oh, yeah, why not? You know, got nothing else to do. I'm stuck in a boring job. So I went into this short form class. And again, I was like, I was just good at it. I just got it straight away. I didn't need the games explained. I just knew I understood it. And it was the first time I was like, oh, I'm good at this, rather than like, I'm shit and everyone else is brilliant at this. And then Pasco got a job at a show called News Review, which is still running. It's a satirical show at the Canal Cafe Theatre.
It's been going for
donkey's years. It's like Guinness World Record of like longest continuous show or something. And she said to me, you've got to do this. It's easy. It's exactly what we do. We just do accents and voices and you write the sketches. You could do this. And I auditioned and didn't get in and felt shit again. And then I auditioned again. I don't think I got in again. I used to literally visibly shake in audition. I was so nervous. And then I think... I started hanging around doing impro, and then, you know, it's like someone had done improv started saying, oh, I'm doing the next News Review, I'm directing it, will you audition? I was a bit more confident, and I got into News Review, and then I started meeting all these comedy people who were like, oh, we do sketches. I was like, what do you mean you do sketches? And I met Pippa Evans, who was like, I do character. And I was like, what do you mean? She said, I just put on an accent, like, go to a club and I do the set. And by that point, Pasco was doing stand-up and I was very afraid of stand-up. I just thought, I can't stand there and be myself. I don't like myself. I don't know how to do that. But I know how to put on a hat and do a stupid voice. I fucking know how to do that. So Pippa really changed my world because I was like, I just didn't know you could... I didn't know it was happening. So when she started doing characters, she said, right, there was a sketch I did where I played a young boy in a News Review called Andrew. She said, right, you write 10 minutes for Andrew. And I did Andrew's Guide to the Northern Ireland Peace Process. And I had this Doctor Who jump and Andrew talks like this and he's trying to explain like Catholicism and Protestant. He had a piece of bread and he was like, some people think the bread is Jesus and some people think the bread is not Jesus. And then they've got very upset. And then he used to explain, he did that history of the Russian Revolution and stuff. Like it just became like, oh, here's a voice that I get and I can write about a historical comedy, which is something I know about. So it just kind of went from there. And then I started gigging and then it took me ages to get an Edinburgh show together. It took me ages until I read The Artist's Way and I was like, right, I've got all these characters I should put this into.
And did you do that in that first Edinburgh show? Lots of different characters?
Yeah, I did six different characters.
Or just your show, though? Nobody
yeah,
else
yeah.
in it?
No, it was a solo show, yeah. So I'd done all these characters for like 2 years, gigging around London and just doing 10 minutes here and there. And everyone kept saying, you should do Edinburgh, you should do Edinburgh. I had no agent, nothing. I'm still just nothing. I'm a receptionist. That's what I'm doing.
Were you still temping?
Yeah, still temping. Like, I was just completely... I had nothing. I'd absolutely... Like, if you'd met me, you'd have said, that girl is a receptionist. That's what she's doing. Occasionally doing terrible fringe theatre. And then finally, I read The Artist... Well, I had the worst summer of my life. I got fired from an Edinburgh show, and he claims he didn't fire me, but we're still friends, and he did. And the year before, he said he wanted me to do his Edinburgh show, a friend of mine, and he changed his mind. I was working at a call centre with all these actors... for ringing charities. It was awful. It's been closed down since because his practices were so bad. And I was washing up a tin of baked beans and you have to like rinse it out. I sliced all my fingers on the tin. I was standing there covered in blood. All my friends were in Edinburgh. This is 2010. And I remember just looking at my hands beating, thinking, your life is so shit. Like, why don't you just do a show? Because it can't get worse, can it? Like, this is, you know, rock bottom. I was like,
did you feel you were?
I thought, like, this is, I am miss all my, and by this point, Pasco's a very successful stand up. All my friends are successful stand ups. Like, I was the only person not doing comedy because I was still going, I'm going to do Macbeth at the RSC.
Right, you so that were, was still there.
It was still there.
Wow.
So I couldn't get anywhere. And I thought, why don't you just fucking do the show? What's the worst? You can't be any worse than this. This is awful. So then in that summer, I then wrote the show and then got it together, started gigging it. And then in 2011, I took it up to Edinburgh with no agent, barely any PR. A friend wrote my press release. And
because it's a very different thing.
Yeah.
Going around doing 10-minute slots and there. But to do, I'm presuming it wasn't like an hour's show.
Yeah, it was an hour's show, yeah. And I just kind of put all the characters together with a very loose theme that I'd booked a variety night and... these were the guests on the variety night, basically. Carriads, Lady Carriads characters, it was called. Yeah, so Andrew was in there with Jacques Lecoq, who's a French parkour guy.
Of course he is.
He used to sit on women and go, under toi, parkour. He used to just flirt outrageously with a woman. And rap, he used to do French rap. And there was Alison, the magician's assistant. And, Joey Bechamel wasn't in there, that was the next year. Joey Bechamel's the manic pixie dream guy I used to do. He's a very loose spoof of Zooey Deschanel. God, who was in it? I can't remember. Anyway. Oh, an actress character. There was an actress character that was trying to...
excuse me.
Bless you. It was basically me, and she was auditioning for TIE, but she was treating it like Shakespeare, and I used to do terrible speeches. So like, I used to do fake Shakespeare and a fake northern woman that, like, you know, I used to say, you know, because I want to show my range, I'm going to use an accent. So watch out for that. And she's 85, because I want to show how good I am as an actor, this character. And, you know, she'd had an abortion, she'd been abused, her husband had left her and he'd hit her. And she used to end every sentence with a cup of tea. And so it's like a fake audition piece, you know, which the actors, like, not everyone else really enjoyed. Yeah, and then I just put it all together. And then from that, I got my agent and my world changed. So
did you get nominated that year?
I got nominated for Best Newcomer, yeah. And, yeah, and I, you know, no one knew who the fuck I was. It was like, I remember standing at the, I went to the, you have a photo shoot for all the nominees, like a couple of days before, and people turn up with their agents and their producers, and I was just by myself. And I was trying to eat a croissant, because I'm always up for free food. And there was two women next to me, and they were like, who the fuck is Carriad Lloyd? And I was like, oh, God. And I don't know, perhaps she's on the free fringe. I've never even heard of her. And I was like... What do I do? This is so awkward. And I just sort of scurried off with my croissant. I was like, well, at least you got a free croissant. You got a free croissant. That's fine.
Oh, God.
But it's fine. I mean, you know, I got nominated. So. Yeah. But it was very, it was a really weird, like it was from nothing to 100, you know, like from literally nobody wanted anything to do with me to.
People want a piece.
Oh, God. Yeah. And I had no agents. So of course, everyone was like, come and meet me. You're going to do this. We'll make you a star. See you, kid. Come this way. So it was really overwhelming. And then the next year I did another show, which was a bit of a disaster because I was sort of still in shock. And I had a show, that show had taken 2 years to write. You're still gigging the other show. I was going to do festivals with the other show. And then suddenly you've got to write the new one. You've got like 6 months to do it. So it was a bit hastily put together, the second one. But it had its moments.
Do you feel under pressure when you're writing a show?
You do, like yeah. That? It depends. Your first show, I think, is a lovely thing in a way because you just don't know. You just don't know what you're doing. So it's a bit like first love. Do you know what I mean? It's like... oh, you're just figuring it out, and who knows? And then it's wonderful, and then
but in a way, there's freedom there as well.
Exactly. I didn't. No one knew me. I didn't know what people from the judging. You know, the judge. Lots of comedians know who's on the judging panel for the big awards. I had no idea. And friends were coming to see my show, and they're like, "Oh, you had four people," and I was like, "Did I? I don't know who they are. I didn't know who any reviewers were. You know, I did a show to six people once, and I think like two of them were reviewers, but I didn't know who they were. Whereas now I'd be like, oh, there they are. Hello. Yeah. I've spoken to you. I've met you. And yeah, it was really free. And it was on the free fringe. And
Was that when the free fringe was just starting?
Well, no, it'd been going a while.
Oh, was it?
Yeah. But it just, the year before, Imran Youssef had been nominated on it. So it was like, it was just becoming respectable.
Right.
It finally, people started going, actually, the other model was really hard. So perhaps this, it used to be Free Fringe was a bit, people were very sniffy about it. And like, well, it's not where the real comedians are. And then it was like.
Not anymore.
Well, no, exactly. It changed. But I think the year before me, it started to change. My year really changed. And then the year after me, someone else got, John Kearns was, I think, one on that year. And he was on the Free Fringe in the same room as I'd been as well. So like, it was. Yeah, it became like a much more, they're completely equal now. And I'd say now, there's probably more, well, it's equal, it's pretty equal because...
Did you feel a lot of pressure writing that second show because of how well the first one had been received?
Yeah, I had a horrible time. Like, I wasn't very good at the success. I found that really... Having come from every door slammed in my face, nobody... You're not good enough to do this dream. Talking to producers who had actively said, no, we don't want to work with you, and then literally 2 weeks later, they're like, hey, Carriad! You're like, oh, I don't feel like I can trust anything.
Yeah.
And obviously, I have such a hangover of my dad, like, the world... Things not being very stable. I'm not very good with massive change. It makes me feel very like, oh God, what's happening? So I felt like suddenly my world was insane. And I'd gone from working completely full time at Southwark College, dealing with teenagers breaking down on me because like their EMA had been taken away and they can't get their fucking bus and they're not going to pass their GCSEs, to going to like this radio meeting and being like, what? Like, what's happening? This is just, yeah, just felt a bit.
How did you
mad.
Deal with that? Because there's obviously it can
badly,
go one
badly.
Way. You can completely shut down, or you can embrace it, or you can run away. I mean, there's lots of things.
I wish I'd taken more time. I'm quite good at doing what I'm told. So then my agent at the time, who were brilliant, but they were like, you need another show and you need to go to the paid fringe and you need to show people like this is what you can do. And so I wish I'd taken more time and just, I know other people then have done different, they've like done that show again for another year and not rushed, but I was like, I've got to give them something new. But then I don't know, I got a pilot out of it at the second show, which I loved doing, even though nothing came of it. It was an amazing experience. So, you know, all of these things,
yeah,
they lead to something else. They lead you somewhere else. You learn from them. You feel better for them. And finally I was doing what I wanted to do. And like, so I...
You realise what it
yeah,
was.
Yeah, I realised I probably want to do comedy. And I care, and I started taking it seriously. I'd never taken it seriously. And I started thinking, oh, I want to do a show that's funny for these reasons and the technique. And I give a shit rather than going, oh, I'll just put a hat on. I'll just put a hat on and do an accent, it'd be all right. It's like going, oh, I care. So yeah, that was amazing. That was completely and utterly amazing. And I still am grateful, so grateful that I get to do this and not... working a receptionist where people don't know my name, call me temp.
Is there still a part of you within yourself that wants to be that
actor? Yes,
lady.
Yes,
you want to be the artist.
100%, 100%. Oh my god, yeah. I think if somebody said, "Now, here you go, do you want to do it?" I'd shit myself.
Yeah, of course.
I think, and I would have to think. Actually, is it what you want to do? Because.
But you don't know yet.
I don't know
until
yet.
You do
until
it.
I've done it. That's how I feel. That's why I did a sort of comedy / serious play in October, because I thought,
well, I remember speaking to you about it, and you're in rehearsals.
Yeah, because and that's why everyone was like, oh, why have you said yes to that? And I was like, because I need to know if I still want to do it. And I loved it. I absolutely loved doing it so much. And I don't want to ever stop doing comedy, but you know those some actors, I think, you know, Olivia Colman is like such a good example, Tamsin Grieg, that kind of make that jump over. I don't even like saying it out loud because I think, oh God, the gods will hear you and say it won't happen. But that's what I'd like, to be able to still do comedy because I love it so much, but not to have people go, oh, you can't do that. You can't do something serious. To go, oh yeah, you can come and do that. Some.
But I think you can do anything. I think we should all be...
I know, and I feel like that about the other way. Like when serious actors come and do comedy, it's great because they bring a different energy to it. It's so nice. And comedians can be quite sloppy. And when I've done, you know, radio comedies with actors, I'm like, oh, look at them. They're really giving it a character. Whereas we can be very in the, like, I know how to make this funny. So I just say that and it'd be funny. It's quite nice. It's quite nice to have a different energy. So I think, yeah, why not? Why shouldn't you be... Why should it be so segregated? It's mental. Like, being good at comedy is as hard as being good at Shakespeare. Like, they're just
absolutely
slightly different skills. So it'd be nice to... It would be very nice.
Carriad, I'm very sad. Very sad, because you've got to go.
I know, I've got to go. I'm sad too, because I think I've waffled
but
away.
It's been really lovely, because even though we've met...
Very
and
lovely.
I was so pleased, because I was the first person to give you your first podcast award this
I know,
year.
I know, and I was so overwhelmed. And then you said I'm from Two Shot, and I was like, oh, I know who you are! I was so overwhelmed at that ceremony, yeah, it was mad.
But, look... Somebody's bouncing.
Somebody's at the door.
Somebody's
this is how
door.
Real
let's just,
it is.
Let's just keep, let's yeah, just keep recording good. And see who it is. Hello?
Hello, we sorry to bother you, but we got the alarm on the fire board. Can
who,
I have a
sorry?
Check?
A fire?
Pre-alarm.
All right.
Can I have a check? Everything is okay.
Yeah, come in. We're just recording the end of a podcast. Come on.
Come in.
I'm so sorry.
That's all right. What's
this
your name?
Very good character acting.
I'm so sorry.
It's okay, man. Don't worry. The fire alarm's just here above these microphones. Do you want to give it a little check? It did go off before, prior to you coming. we could just carry on and get over everything.
I just think this is really good character acting. It's really good.
Do you come in?
This is strong.
Try to reset.
Is this Mike Lee play? Is this when you haven't told me properly what's happening?
It's not actually a podcast. I know that you
have
love.
Have you worked with him?
I know you love the improvising.
Yeah. Yeah, this is it. I'm happy. I'm going to start improvising.
I'm just going to. We'll just sign it off now because I know you've got to go.
I know, and it's not as exciting as it appeared at first, is it?
No, it's very dramatic. With
it got very dramatic.
But thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Did you enjoy it?
I really enjoyed it.
Right.
I felt like I waffled.
No, you didn't.
Okay, good.
It was lovely. Thank you.
Oh, can you call me in the phone? Yeah.
Love it.
Bye, guys.
And another episode is done. Sorry, let me turn this back off. Right, there we go. What about that? How fantastic is Cariad? Now, look, I'm sure you do, but if you don't subscribe and listen to the Griefcast, it's not all doom and... Well, it is. It is about death. But it is very funny, and it's life-affirming, and it's quite healing, I must admit. So do check out the Griefcast and Podcast Word Cloud and The Cinemile. I cannot recommend all of those highly enough. So a massive thank you to you for downloading and subscribing. You do subscribe, don't you? It's dead easy. Just hit subscribe. If you want to give us a review, that's absolutely fine. You can do that. If you can't be arsed, then that's fine too. It'd be great if you could, though. So a huge thank you to Cariad. And no doubt I'm going to see her in the not-too-distant future. Well, that's it. I'm going to go. I'm going to have this bath, try and get myself sorted, because I've got 4 days off work and I've got 11 days till we start recording some new episodes. And you're going to pop when you find out who's coming on the Two Shot Podcast. We've got some incredible guests lined up. I'm dying to tell you, but I'm not going to do it. And not through teasing, but only because, right, if I tell you and then something happens, like the other day, I was supposed to record at 5 o'clock yesterday, and I had this cold, and I texted this person, and I said, look, I'm not in a fit state. If I'm not in a fit state, I don't want to give you my germs. And also, it's not going to be a good episode, and I really want it to be. So we're going to meet up again in March, when this person is back in the country, and we're going to do it, and it's going to be fantastic. So thank you so much for being here, and until next week, take care of yourself, all right? Don't be careful when you're picking up that towel out of the bath. You know, just take care. Don't do what I did, you know, just be careful. So that's it. Until next week, I've been Craig Parkinson. He's been Producer Griff, and this has been the Two Shot Podcast. Take care of yourself.
The Two Shot Podcast is presented by me, Craig Parkinson, recorded and produced by Thomas Griffin for Splicing Block. Our music, our brilliant music, is courtesy of Then Thickens. Cheers.